This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
How very much I've loved you. How very much I've tried my best to give you the good life. It was said by the greatest of prophets, from time immemorial, no man takes my life from me, I lay my life down. If we can't live in peace, then let's die in peace. We've been so betrayed. We have been so terribly betrayed.
Before starting this episode, I need to provide a warning that it contains extremely disturbing content relating to mass suicide and murder. This will be the final episode in the series on the Jonestown Massacre, and in order to try to make some sense of what happened, I thought it would be necessary to take a look at the people who were closest to Jim Jones, his sons and his wife. So in this episode, you will hear from his biological son, Stephen, and Jim Jones Jr., his adopted black son. And what about the woman behind the man, his wife, Marceline? Who was she? And was she as culpable in what happened at Jonestown? First, let's find out more about Jones's biological son, Stephen Gandy Jones. In his childhood, it's not surprising to hear that Stephen idolised his father, and here is how he described those early days of the People's Temple. Quote, "I lived in a community that was filled with every walk of life, every colour in the rainbow, every level of education. For the most part, we lived in harmony most of the time, especially early on. It was not fake. I am so grateful for that because it showed me the truth of that, the beauty of that, the importance of that. So I loved that about him. However, as he grew older, his feelings towards his father and the temple began to change. Stephen described how his father's life became dominated by his role as the head of the People's Temple. Before moving to Guyana, the congregation got up to about 5,000 members. He said, quote, "Not only was Dad never around, but it felt like everybody else had Dad. We didn't have our father, and they were taking our father away from us. So there was that resentment as well. It was hard on the family." Even though he went to public schools, Stephen never really learned to live in the outside world. Quote, "The minute I stepped out onto the street, I felt so uncomfortable. America was a genuinely unfriendly place for a boy from an interracial family and community, and Dad knew how to fan that into a fear of everything that lay beyond the temple walls. He was always preaching the hostility towards us and warning people what would happen or what could happen from the outside. The white man was so preached against by my father as a way of winning the black people. And here I am, a white man, feeling like everybody resents me and I have something to apologize for. There was always that guilt fed to you by my father that kept you in check, kept you thinking, maybe I'm wrong. The guilt for being selfish and questioning this." Stephen was 17 years old when he moved to Guyana to help build the compound. Here is how he felt being there. Quote, "My experience in Jonestown was this. When I first got there, I was happy and I was really enjoying myself. I really was coming to understand what it meant to be part of something bigger than me. We had a goal that was attainable, not grand. We're going to build a town for the people we love. Right? We're going to do it together to the best of our ability. The common theme was people wanted to make a difference. We had an organizational structure an agricultural team, the education projects, the infirmary or hospital team, it was a whole community. But Stephen said once Jones actually moved to Jonestown with his followers, that's when things began to change. It wasn't a nice place to be anymore. He became controlling and everyone had to work harder. There were food issues and he was tight with spending money. He went on to say that at some point everything about his father and Jonestown became very superficial. Quote, "There was nothing spiritual about my father. Of course, in my view of things, he had every bit the loved and juicy soul in him that everyone else does, but he had lost complete sight of that. His entire existence was superficial." Stephen said his father thrived on adulation and that it always seemed that he needed more, whether it was genuinely by doing something that people appreciated or by other tactics. Quote, "My father was starved for attention from a very young age and it never let up. If anything, it intensified. My experience with my father was that he was more an actor than genuine, always was. He was always aware of eyes on him, because all that mattered to my father was his perception of other people's perceptions of him. My father could, in an instant, identify what was most important to you and probably what you were most afraid of. He could quickly convey that he was the one to protect you from what you were afraid of and to help you have whatever it is that you longed for." And here is how he felt about being part of Jones's so-called Rainbow Family. "I never liked the title, the Rainbow Family. We were a mixed bag for sure, especially for that time. In many respects, that's lovely, regardless of the motivation. But what I felt was that much of what was created as a family was done for show." And over time, Stephen soon tired of the temple. Quote, "I think I knew it was just a bunch of junk and that it was really about nothing. I got sick of the same speeches, the insisting people stay awake, the constantly testing people. I grew accustomed to my father having sex with temple members, sometimes women, sometimes men. This was when he started bragging about taking 16 people in one day and all that crap. Dad, like any other good demagogue, would conjure up fear. What I'm hearing in the audience is all the gloom and doom, the pending nuclear war. We're all going to be ushered into or put into concentration camps if we're not exterminated some other way. There are white racists around every corner that want to take us out. The immediate community that we were in Redwood Valley, all hated us, as far as my father was concerned. His message was incredibly violent as time went on, and it was erratic. If we weren't having an open meeting where he was trying to bring in new members, we were having closed meetings where he was trying to control the members." Stephen recalls practicing the fake suicides and how there was a constant message of dying for the cause. Quote, "The idea of giving my life, losing my life, probably in a violent, horrible way. Yeah, I was kind of afraid of that. I was afraid of what he might do and what he said we had to do and what he said would happen to us." But for Stephen, leaving was unimaginable. Quote, "The temple was still my only life, and I didn't really see any alternative to it. I would have been a traitor to the greatest cause there ever was. I believed there was too much racism, and there was a need for change. I would have been doing more than just leaving a family. It would have been like I was a counter-revolutionary in some sense." Toward the end, as he watched the array of barbiturates, amphetamines and tranquilizers that now slurred his father's speech and sometimes left him physically unable to leave the Jonestown house, Stephen says he contemplated killing his father. Quote, "When it really came down to it, I thought there wasn't any need, because I thought he would be dead in a couple of months anyway. And after Jones radioed the Georgetown house and instructed everyone to carry out the suicides, Stephen, however, decided to go to the US Embassy and inform officials that something was about to go down at Jonestown. However, he was not believed. So the question is, if he had been believed, could the tragedy have been avoided? It's hard to say, but I think at that point, things had progressed too far and they probably would have been too late anyway. So when the full horror of what had happened came to light, as the surviving son of Jim Jones, Stephen came under much scrutiny. On YouTube, you can find a video of Stephen speaking at a packed press conference where he was grilled about his father and Jonestown. He was probed about his involvement in the temple and what he knew about his father's plan to commit a mass suicide. Subsequent to this media grilling, Stephen was arrested on suspicion of abetting the mass murders. In particular, he was accused of the murders of Sharon and her children in the Georgetown house, as he had been there when the message from Jones had come through. Stephen spent 3 months in a Guyanese jail, but was ultimately cleared of any complicity. In the aftermath of Jonestown, Stephen had years of struggles with alcohol and drug addiction, but today he is in a much better place, living happily with his wife and 3 daughters, and he says that he has forgiven his father. However, Jim Jones's other son, Jim Jones Jr., had a very different view about their father than Stephen had. He said, quote, "I was a true believer. And when I say a true believer, I believed in all the things that people's temples could have been." He explained how his view of their father was different from Stephen's because of being adopted into the family. Quote, "I was given a fine education, a fine life. Stephen's paradigm was different. He was born and he looked at life and he listened to my father, listened to my mother, and he goes, 'Why did he bring me into this world? I didn't have that choice. I was grateful that I was safe in the world that I was brought into.'" Jim Jones Jr. would find out later in his life that he had been the first African-American child adopted by a Caucasian family in the state of Indiana, but says he didn't know this because there was no race in his family. Quote, "I had Koreans in the family. I just thought I had a better tan." He found out later in life that Jones and his wife had adopted him from an orphanage and that the staff were surprised when they picked an African-American child to adopt. They tried to persuade them that they should adopt a white child. As word spread of Jones's decline in health due to alcohol and drug abuse, Jim Jr. said that he did notice some things change in his father, but he believed they were due to the pressure that people put on him. Quote, "I saw the preaching all night long, the tirades of discipline against other people. People were punished severely. I saw that and I thought, you know, did it sit right with me? No. But did I step up against it? No, I didn't." Jim Jr. remembers the day of the murders. He had been in Georgetown with the basketball team when he received a call from his father. Quote, "He said we were going to visit Mr. Fraser. Now, I was the director of communications on our security team, so I knew what that code meant. That code meant revolutionary suicide. My first reaction was, there's got to be a different way. No, Dad, we've got to do something different. And he goes, no, you need to be strong. You need to be our avenging angels. My father told us to find knives, piano wire, poison if we were able to find it, and commit suicide." Jim said that on the day of the massacre, people were manipulated into believing they needed to lay down their lives in protection. Quote, "They had been told that people were going to come in and take their children away. They were going to separate us. and they were going to invade our community. What my father did was very manipulative. He has the children ingest the cyanide first. And I mean, I have three boys now. And I've got to tell you, if I saw my kids dying, why would I want to live? These three sons were born in the US after Jonestown. However, although Jim Jr. was not a casualty of Jonestown, he did have a wife, his mother, and two children at that time who did die that day. He has often wondered if he would have ingested the drink if he'd been there that day. Quote, "When I look at my wife, my mother, my family who ingested it, I cannot say that I wouldn't have, out of respect for what they did." After returning to the US, Jim Jr. said he went by the common name James Jones for 15 years. It wasn't until they used the name Jim at work that he took the name back. Quote, "I realized that's who I am. I'm Jim Jones Jr. I'm the African-American son that was adopted in Indiana by a Caucasian family. I'm part of an organization that tried to build a new world. 900 people died, and I miss them every day. But I also recognize that they tried. They tried something. They failed horrifically, but they tried. And out of that, I've taken a lot of pride to realize that I'm Jim Jones Jr. I can't hide from that." Jim says he has forgiven his father, quote, "The mental illness was exacerbated by the drug use and the absolute power when no one challenged him. When you put that cocktail together, the mind can spiral out of control, and that's what Jim Jones did. He spiraled out of control and self-destructed." And now let's finish by looking more closely at the woman behind Jim Jones, his wife, Marceline. Just how was she able to stand by him despite the mistresses, the children that he bore to them, and the well-documented physical and mental abuse that he unleashed on Temple members? Marceline and Jones met when they were both working at a hospital, and she continued her career as a medical professional right up until her death. Jones's liaisons with Temple women was common knowledge, and he justified them by stating that his wife supposedly was unable to engage in sexual intercourse and also because she was mentally unwell. One significant mistress was a lady named Carolyn Layton, and Jones would father a child to her. She had previously been married to the man who had shot inside the plane at the airstrip. Jones also had another liaison with a woman named Grace Stowen, and they had a boy named John Stowen. And as we saw in a previous episode, it was the custody battle over the boy which precipitated the six-day siege at Jonestown. This boy would also die on that fateful day at Jonestown. It's been written that Marceline was deeply affected by her husband's affairs, yet she willingly signed a document requesting that Carolyn Layton take over the mothering responsibilities of the Jones's children in the event of Marceline's death. Although the paternity of the boy John was never confirmed, Marceline still supported Jones's claim to have fathered the boy. She did this by witnessing an affidavit assigning parentage to Jim Jones. During a white night meeting, he even spoke about having sex with Grace Stowen and his desire to marry her, but added that he chose not to because people would leave the temple if he divorced Mother, as Marceline was referred to. Although Marceline expressed her desire for a divorce from Jones, she never pursued it because he threatened to separate her from her children if she left him. Now let's look at what her son Stephen had to say about his mother. This is what he wrote about her, quote, "Mum was not an activist, let alone a revolutionary. She was a wife and mother and daughter, and that energy, that purpose, extended beyond her immediate family. Raised by her parents on kindness, loyalty, and conviction, she carried those values into her adulthood and marriage, which took place in a standby and behind your man era. Within that kind of spousal mindset, the same values which won her love and respect of so many, eventually, some would say quickly, eroded and twisted into a codependency and self-doubt that would shatter her heart and lead her to her death at age 51. To this day, Marceline is the most loving, gentle, and giving person I have ever known. That is my true experience of her, and I can no longer question it. Everyone else who knew her feels the same way. Mum's failure, her complicity, lies in her inability to leave Dad, and in the compromises born of her increasingly misguided belief that she couldn't change and manage him. Our safety was always on her mind, and she had to protect what little refuge she had. Mum encouraged and supported, with time and energy and money, my every dream and wish, no matter how counter-revolutionary Dad might deem them. She was always gentle and supportive. She protected me from harm as best that she could. She dreamt aloud for me when Dad would accept nothing but absolute self-sacrifice for the cause. But in reality, Mum's devotion to her families, both immediate and temporal, a distant second, may have done us more harm than if she had been a hardline devotee of my father's, a fellow activist. Mum made things tolerable, and the fact that she stuck around undoubtedly caused some people to question their dissent. Did Mum's lack of conviction, her inability to extricate me and my siblings from the madness, sacrifice us in some way to his brutishness? Sure, but you've got to understand that pulling away from Dad, especially with his kids, his natural born, was a hard thing to do. I would have worried for our very lives had I been in her place. But Mum was hooked on Dad. On some level, I think she was hooked on me. If anything, Mum was too devoted to me and the rest of her children. It cost her life and saved mine. Mum is the reason I survived, physically and psychologically, relatively speaking. Okay, maybe she should have left even when we said we wouldn't. Maybe Mum should have ignored her fear that he would harm or kill us, as he had threatened to do, and taken matters to the courts. Maybe a stronger woman would have ignored cultural conditioning and her own mother's admonishments and left long before we children could have a choice, when she could still throw us on her hip and spirit us away while Dad was off ministering to his flock. But that didn't happen. By the time Mum had seen enough to leave, not only could she not find a way out for all of us, but there may not have been one. Now, for me, after viewing so much content about Jonestown, it struck me that his wife, Marceline, was rarely seen or heard, but I did manage to find the following short recording of her. So take a listen.
I cannot say why. I can say that I think that certainly when people get to the place where they can't make the total commitment, that the kind of life that Jim Jones lives requires, and they decide that they do no longer want to be a part of it because of the total commitment that is required. Not because he is dictatorial, as has been charged, because if anything, he's otherwise. He encourages creativity in people. But when the time comes, when you see a man that lives with the people, not above the people, and for the people, you come to a place in your life where you have to make a choice whether you're willing to make that kind of a commitment.
After listening to her speak, I came to the conclusion that she was as duplicitous as he was. How could she speak so highly of him when she knew that he was physically and mentally abusing temple members so viciously over so many years? So I'm afraid that I can't view her in such a sympathetic way as her son Stephen had portrayed her. I guess you will just have to make up your own mind about her. Now that I've come to the end of this series on Jonestown, there is one burning question that I have. Did Jones have the right idea in the beginning to create a racial and social utopia? Did he really believe what he was preaching? Was it genuine at the start? But then did the drugs really make him turn crazy? Or did he have a master plan right from the beginning? Here are Stephen's thoughts about this. Quote, "We were not a good organization that turned bad or lost its way. We were not healthy then sick. From the very beginning, we were ruled, not led, but ruled, subjugated and manipulated by a narcissistic, paranoid, bitter, disillusioned, delusional, and frequently ridiculous man who was, as far as I can tell, pretty disturbed before he made it out of his childhood. He was able to hide the negative, cruel, and unbalanced aspects of his personality from many people. Some of them began to see through him and escaped his grasp. Others rationalized them or were so compromised themselves that they stayed with Jones until the very end. For me, I've always viewed myself as someone who could never be manipulated by a cult or fall victim to other sorts of scams. So it's really hard for me to fathom how so many people could allow themselves to be so manipulated. But now that I know the story more thoroughly, I have changed my view on this somewhat. I think that he really did present something wonderful to the African American community. So it doesn't surprise me that his message of racial equality attracted so many people. I probably would have been drawn to him myself had I been black. But where I draw the line is the fact that people actually believed all of the fake healings and just stood by while the emotional and physical abuse was happening. These should have been the red flags. I know there were people that saw these warning signs and left, but so many just did not. Over the 40 years since Jonestown, so many have tried to understand and explain how Jones had such a firm hold on so many people over so many years. I think Stephen sums it up well in the following audio.
There were a lot of reasons I think that people ended up taking the poison. I don't know who took it, who was injected. I think more than anything, it was out of loyalty to everybody else there. In my case, if I had been there, I know I had a strong will to live, but I think that it was so important to me, or how I was perceived by the people of my community was so important to me that it might have taken me to my death. Ask yourself, what would someone have to tell you? Or what would someone have to do to you to get you to do something that you couldn't possibly believe you were capable of? And examine that. Learn from it. Don't judge it. Don't stand separate from it. Be willing to stand in the shoes of the people you're judging. And I hope that, you know, 900 plus people, that they died, and the way they died, might offer us something so that their lives won't be in vain.
And now to finish this series on Jonestown, you will hear audio of the People's Temple Children's Choir as they sing so joyfully and offer a warm welcome to their church. The upbeat nature of the song is in such stark contrast to the absolute tragedy that was Jonestown. The song will be followed by the ending of the death tape. All you can hear is soothing music playing, while the residents of Jonestown lay eerily silent in their final resting places. May they rest in peace.